is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
It's how the best operate. It's not only how the best operate in basketball, it's how they operate in all sports and in business. It's how it goes. And the reason why it's such a barrier to so many coaches is because it doesn't happen overnight. Your year one as a coach at a new school or first year head coach or whatever, your year one is probably the predominance of the time you spend is program, not team. I say this all the time to coaches. It's like, you weren't hired to be the varsity basketball team's coach. You were hired to direct the basketball program. There's a big difference.
Randy Sherman is the owner and founder of Radius Athletics, a basketball coaching consulting firm, where he consults with basketball coaches at all levels on coaching philosophy, practice planning, X's and O's, and all things basketball. Sherman's basketball experiences range from athletic performance training to leading basketball programs. While a head basketball coach for 9 seasons at the interscholastic level, Sherman led teams to 4 regional tournaments and 6 25-plus win seasons. Radius Athletics exists to serve, grow, and develop basketball coaches at all levels. The Radius Athletics Mentoring Program, RAMP, helps coaches move their teams towards simple, seamless basketball. Check out our website, www.hoopheadspod.com, where you can listen to every episode in our archive. After you've listened to this episode, or one of your other favorites, please head over to your favorite podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating and review. Those reviews help others in the basketball community find our show. Make sure you're subscribed to the Hoopheads podcast so you never miss an episode. The pod is available on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Play, and YouTube. Please get ready to learn and take some notes as you listen to this episode with Randy Sherman from Radius Athletics.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome from Radius Athletics, Randy Sherman. Randy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, guys. Looking forward to talking some hoops with you guys tonight.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun to get to know more about what you're doing right now, because I think you have a lot of interesting things to share with the high school coaches and college coaches that are out there listening. So we want to start by talking a little bit about your background in coaching and share the story of how you got into, or when you decided that coaching was going to be something that you wanted to do for a career or for your life.
Sure. I grew up in rural Texas, like small town Texas. So, you know, everyone's into sports, you know, it was pretty much just ingrained into the community. And so other than my father, the male role models in my life were coaches and teachers that also coached and they were heroes to a young kid in Texas. And being in Texas, I was probably more inclined toward football and track and field.
not surprising there.
Yes, you know? Especially the part of Texas where I grew up in East Texas is you know, really big time football, and everything sort of centered around Friday night. And so my initial plan, if you will, was I was going to be a football coach and a track and field coach. Those were my two main sports. I only played 1 year of varsity basketball. Wasn't much of a player. And so that's what the plan was, but plans change, right? So, when I went to college and did my student teaching, there was the women's basketball coach at the school I did my student teaching. She was like, I know you want to be a coach and you probably want to do football and I know you're into track and stuff. So, but I could really use some help during my athletic period working with the girls basketball team. I'm kind of in there by myself. And if you want to just help me out, I'd really appreciate it. So I did. And the rest is sort of history. I kind of liked it. And being that I really got some hands-on experience during that time as a student assistant, if you will, I wasn't doing my student teaching for my college teaching certificate. And And she let me kind of get my hands dirty with practice and drills, and I took it from there. So that's kind of how the basketball thing came about. So
you were again, hooked. You were hooked on basketball.
Yeah, it just felt like experience. It wasn't the initial plan, but you know, plans change and you just kind of roll with it.
Absolutely. So then kind of take us through the chronology of your basketball coaching career and lead us up to the point where you decide that you're going to get into Radius Athletics. So kind of just take us through sort of your stops on your career, and we can touch on a little bit at each one of those.
Yeah, I quickly kind of became a head basketball coach at a small town in East Texas, and coached everything, but basketball was the main thing, and sort of moved my way up the ladder, and I served as a head coach for 9 years and coached for 11 years total in Texas, and had some really good teams and good players. And what I'd say I was most fortunate was I worked in some schools where athletics was very important and where it was taken seriously by not only the administration, but the community and parents. And that more than my coaching talents is what led to some success, some personal and professional changes kind of caused me to take a step away from coaching. And I got into athletic performance, strength and conditioning type stuff. And I was looking for a way to get into basketball, but kind of a way to make it more on my terms without being a teacher or a coach or work in an educational setting. Or I just kind of got a taste of sort of being my own boss during the time as a trainer.
Right.
And thought, well, I really miss basketball, but I really like this situation here too. So that's sort of what gave birth to Radius Athletics.
All right, cool. Before we jump to that, I want to ask you one question about the strength and conditioning performance piece of it. Because one of the things that I find to be interesting is if I go back, let's say 8 to 10 years ago, and I probably don't even have to go back that far, but it seems like there really was nobody in that strength and conditioning private business model. And now it just seems like that's exploded. And so one of the theories that I have on that is that it just seems like there's such a demand for it, because the things that a lot of the guys that are doing the strength and conditioning and performance aspects are, you know, working a lot on the athleticism piece, that I think kids, let's say 25, 30 years ago, that were out playing in the park all the time and playing such a wide variety of sports and just running around the neighborhood and playing tag and climbing trees, that a lot of that athleticism that kids who are my age, I'm 49, I think developed at that time, you developed it in a different way. And now I think I used to kind of scoff at the athletic performance when it first came out, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, and I'd see people working in a gym with kids on their running form and how to land and doing all those things. And I'd kind of look over when I was doing my basketball training and go, gosh, why would anybody pay for that? It just seems ridiculous. And now, as I've seen more of it and I've learned more and I've gotten to know guys who are in that space, I just think there's a tremendous need for it, because kids don't have the same variety of athletic backgrounds that kids maybe who are my age had. So talk a little bit about what you did as a performance coach and why that's so important. Cause I think it's important for people to understand why that athletic performance piece is so key to being a successful athlete.
Okay, sure. This is a great topic. I enjoy talking about this. So I'll tackle these one at a time and offer some thoughts. So I think what you're describing is what I would call, and what others in the industry would call, functional strength. Where the strength you mentioned, an athlete or someone develops through playing and pushing and pulling and climbing and all of those things, I would call that functional strength. And there may be a lack of it due to the things you mentioned, but I think it's the duty of a coach to restore that, because it has an injury prevention. It has an injury prevention element to it. These kids today, or a lot of them, are specializing in single sports, right? So they're in the same modalities year around, If they're a, you know, a runner, they're running all the time, every day. If they're a basketball player, they're sort of in that sphere all the time. So developing a well-rounded athlete might have to be supplemented by the weight room and different strength and conditioning protocols. I would say too that it seems like now with things like, you know, super competitive tryouts for teams, super competitive just to get a roster spot at your high school, to get selected for the top level AAU or EYBL program. Like, parents are really invested in their student athletes and their children, and it's probably seen as an edge, quite honestly. Like, I'm doing everything I can to help my son or daughter reach their goals, make the team they want to make, get that scholarship. So it's sort of like probably going to become the cost of doing business for a lot of people in a lot of areas of the country of not only do I have a basketball specialist helping with me with my game outside of the school setting, outside of the AAU setting, but I have a strength and conditioning specialist helping me to increase my speed, agility, mobility, vertical jump, all those things to just create one more little edge that someone may have over their competition.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's something that is definitely valuable and something that if you get to the right person and somebody who can train specifically for whatever the sport is, whether it's basketball or whether it's football, whatever it might be, I think when you can get with somebody who does a great job, that it does, to your point, get an edge. And I think the other thing that you mentioned that is critical is nowadays there's so much competition, and I think the pool of talent is so much deeper, especially in basketball. We've talked to some high school coaches about the fact that, you know, you go back 20 years ago and let's say players 8 through 12 on your varsity roster, a lot of those kids are not necessarily very skilled. Mm-hmm. They're just not as skilled of players. You might have like the football kid who does, you know, set screens and is really physical. And nowadays those kids are all really, really skilled, whether that's right, because they're in a trainer or they're working AAU, whatever it might be. And so the competition to even get one of those spots at the end of the bench is really tough. And so I think you make a great point about being able to get an edge from getting that athletic performance piece of it in place.
Yeah, I also think that at least during my time as a coach, and even with the coaches I speak with now that you know, to win their championship, whether that's to meet their goals as a team, to win their district title, advance to regional, state, whatever, they're looking for an edge too. And I do think there might be a certain faction of their competition who's not a believer in the weight room and it's just maybe a market inefficiency that the coach, if they'll dedicate 30 minutes, three times a week, something like that to it, they might find that it's a way to sort of carve out a little bit of competitive edge by emphasizing something that maybe your peers are not.
Yeah, for sure. It's amazing that, you know, the industry basically didn't exist to any degree, again, on the private side of it. Obviously, mm-hmm. you know, weight training and performance has been around in a team setting for a long time, but on the individual player going and finding, you know, a trainer, that piece of it didn't exist. And I think you're right about it being, you know, being a separator and being a way for kids to distinguish or change themselves, to separate themselves from the rest of the group that's out there. So, it's just interesting how these industries develop from nothing into all of a sudden there's something. And I'm amazed by here in the Cleveland area, again, the number of people that are not only offering the basketball side, but the number of performance, athletic performance trainers that are out there has really skyrocketed. All right, let's jump from that.
Sure.
And talk into how you got started with Radius Athletics and tell us the story of, you already mentioned that you kind of wanted to figure out a way to do basketball more full time and kind of get into it that way. So talk about how the idea, the business of Radius Athletics came to pass.
Well, it didn't, the idea didn't start as a business. It started more as a hobby. I have a couple really good coaching colleagues and friends here in Texas. I'll name them by name because I defer the credit to them. One is a coach in Stamford, Texas, named Dean Edwards. The other is now a principal at Ford High School in Quinlan, Texas. His name is Jason Wallen. Two really good friends of mine when we were talking about, man, I want to get back in, just talking about what you and I've talked about wanting to get back into basketball in some space, but not necessarily coaching directly. They encouraged me, and it's like, man, some of the things you did, some of the way your teams played, the way you guys practice was really unique. I always enjoyed watching your teams play and hearing you talk about basketball. You should start using Twitter and maybe start a blog and just share little tweets and thoughts and diagrams and drawings and things like that you did as a coach. And I was like, oh, that's nonsense. No one will pay attention to that.
Right.
That's where people like tweet funny cat videos and stuff. Like there's nothing there, but I went ahead and gave it a try and it took off and I started to see the power of social media and blogging and just how it can be amplified. If someone who's got a big following likes something you said, they share it, and then it just sort of snowballs. And that's how the idea was born. How it kind of turned into a business is a little different story. I don't know if you want to hear that too.
Yeah, but, definitely want to hear that.
I would say, again, it's kind of a silly story, but one night my wife and I were lying in bed and she's excited to show me on her computer this fitness community for females that a couple of female trainers, you know, they set up a website where you had to pay to join and get like diet plans and things like that. And she's showing me this, like, you know, I'm like, okay, I'll pretend to listen.
And, right, understand.
Okay. But then I was like, wait a second, how did they do this? Like, so they got a following of people and they set it up like this and it's turned in. She's like, yeah, they have thousands of people that pay them X amount of dollars. And I was like, oh, okay. And I got interested.
I
got a little interested. Yeah. So I just sort of, honestly, these two like yoga girls in California that set up a community and they built it through social media and I started to maybe dedicate myself a little bit more time to learning about how to execute what they did for myself. And that's how it turned into what I call now a consulting business. I feel like I consult with coaches. I don't necessarily tell them what to do or give them, you know, like say, no, you're wrong. Or I feel like I just consult and I sort of give them advice, like maybe sometimes play devil's advocate, sometimes help them maybe see things that might be some unintended consequences of decisions they make, whether that's X's and O's or program design or whatever. So it kind of, that's how it all got started.
Very cool story. So I want to ask you, how long from the time that your coaching friends said, hey, let's put, you know, you should start putting some stuff online. Mm-hmm. How long was that until the business piece of it came to pass? That's the first part of the question. I'll let you answer that and then I'll come back with part two.
Maybe a year. Okay. It's 9 months, 9 months to a year.
And then from there, how long was it until you felt like, so after that year, how long was it from there that you felt like, boy, this is viable. This is something that I now see how big the community can be and what it can be. How long was it until you said, hey, I really think I've got something here?
Almost instantly. I would say even without a big following in social media at the time when I launched the idea, you know, one of the, I don't even remember who it is. So if you're listening, sorry, I'm not giving you credit, but someone coined the phrase, start before you're ready. Right. Like don't, you know, like so many times, even as coaches, we feel like we got to research everything. I got to talk to every coach in the history of basketball who's run the pick and roll, and I got to watch every video, and you just spend all your time planning and none of your time doing. Right. So I just did. And that's kind of the way I coach too. I was like, I just did it, you know, and we'll figure it out as we go, and it'll iterate, and we'll learn from a mistake, and we'll scrap this and keep that. And I think that it really, even without a huge following, I had a core group of coaches who were really liking the content I was putting out there. They jumped in immediately and told friends, made some great affiliations with companies like Fast Model, who their tool Fast Draw was instrumental in what I do. And so they helped amplify it. So really almost immediately I started picking up interest. Now, when did it turn into what I would call a job? Maybe another year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that first group of people that come on, so you're okay. You start throwing videos up on, you know, Twitter, you start putting plays and diagrams and blog posts and that kind of stuff. You start doing all that. When do you start getting, obviously you see the social media start to grow, but do you start getting feedback from people? Are people reaching out to you, you know, via email or calling you and saying, hey, I really like this stuff, or, you know, sending you direct messages? How did the feedback piece of it come back to you initially as people were starting to find the things that you were doing? Do you remember what that feedback was like initially?
All the things you mentioned: emails, direct messages, just responding to tweets, commenting at, you know, at the end of a blog when you've got the little part where you can write comments or questions. And so all of those things, it came in from a lot of different portals. So all of those things. And I made a pact to myself that, like, I'm going to respond to everybody, right? So I'm not going to get too big and too big time and, you know, get to thinking, you know, I'm too good for, I'm going to respond to everyone. From, if it's a fourth grade coach looking for, you know, what they should do, man or zone, or a MBA assistant who reached out to me, I'm responding to everybody. That was a lot of work. I worked harder at this than I ever worked as a coach.
And, I believe it. I believe it.
In literally times with a laptop in my lap from sun up till well past sundown, responding, because I just wanted to the coaches to feel like, this guy, while I'm not, I always say there's a lot of coaches who could do what I'm doing and probably scale it much bigger than I could. Like imagine if Bob Hurley Sr. did this, or if someone like, Coach K retired and started doing, like, obviously people would have a great interest in that, but, like, they're not available, right?
Correct.
I always say the number one quality of a mentor is availability, right? So you go to a big clinic with 5,000 people in the auditorium listening to Tom Izzo speak, and he's going to do the courtesy thing, like, hey, yeah, just call us off. You're never going to hear, if you got a follow-up question, like, you're not going to hear from him, right? While I'm not Tom Izzo, I will help you. So which mentor do you want? A big time guy that you keep chasing and pursuing, or do you want a mentor that will help you? Like, I'm not them, sorry, but I'll help you.
For sure.
That's why I made a pact to myself that it may not be instantly, it may not be till the next day or 2 days later, but if I'm reached out to, you will get a response. So that pact became pretty tough to stay on top of after a while, but it's I still keep it today.
That's awesome. So you're doing all those responses yourself, or do you have somebody now that helps you to respond, or is it still just you responding?
It's still a one man shop. So
that's awesome.
Sometimes I'll get a message like, oh, Radius Athletics, I love the stuff you guys put out, or I love you guys. And I'm like, yeah, it's just, I think I've just done Randy. My job. I think I've done my job because I've maybe portrayed it to be quote unquote bigger than it is, but like it's me in a home office that's really not impressive, and that's it. So
that's awesome. That's fantastic. So how many on a daily basis, how many inquiries, questions do you get from let's say total, but then also how many like new people do you have reaching out to? Because I'm sure obviously you have people that, you know, are part of your program that reach out to you, but how many new inquiries are you getting, let's say coming in on an average day or an average week, average month, you know, however you want to frame that?
Yeah. So right now I prioritize the members that I work with. Obviously they're the ones that are financially invested. So
for sure.
So I carve out time of my day every day to converse with them. We have a chat room set up that's just for our membership where I couldn't even put a number on the number of, and it's not just asking me. So now what I've done is connected other coaches who are trying to do some of the same things across the country, world actually, that they can speak with one another as well as get my input. So I couldn't even put a number on that. I mean, that they're probably in there chatting about the NBA draft lottery right now and talking about. So I couldn't even put a number on that. But as far as new inquiries go, it's really seasonal. It seems like now that I've done this for like 4 years, I've sort of picked up on when there's peak coaching attentiveness, right? The spring and summer from the high school coaches, at least, it tends to slow down. The fall when school court sort of resumes in August, September, it picks back up. You know, I'd say, and then I stay active on Twitter every day, but I do pay attention to the seasons. And I would say 5 to 6 a day, coaches probably reach out with emails or questions.
Gotcha. So, yeah, that's – wow, it's really cool.
That's outside of the membership.
Right, understood. One of the things that I love about what you're doing, and it's one of the things that we're hoping to kind of do here, is – being able to connect the coaches that have become a part of what we're doing, being able to connect them outside of, or whether it's inside some form, you know, platform that we put together, or just connect people who have been on the podcast. And that's one of the things that I'm fascinated by. So how did you set that up so that coaches could connect within Radius Athletics? How do they connect inside of your platform? How did you do that?
Well, that's probably one thing that I need to work on as I continue to grow. Honestly, sometimes I feel like I've added people faster than I've kept my infrastructure up to date. So I use third party apps and things like that. So for example, any of our members that are in the top level of our membership tiers, I invite them to a chat room on an app called GroupMe. Really okay. Simple. It's free. They set it up through their email, download it on their phone. I really found that like for a while, it was just me talking to individual coaches through Skypes and GoToMeeting links and things like that. And then I got the idea of like, you know, I've got a few coaches who I'm answering the same questions 3 or 4 times a day, right? In different online clinics. I need to figure out a way to bring them together. And so it feels more like a virtual classroom or a virtual meeting room. And I just sort of looked for like chat apps on you know, App Store. And I use GoToMeeting. It's not on my website necessarily so they don't enter it through radiusathletics.com. I just send them an invite in their welcome email that they get when they join. And they jump in and that's really been another thing that I've learned that almost bumped the business up another notch was your phones, man. We're all on our phones, right? Even the guy who says, "Oh, I'm not on my phone very much." Yes, you are. Everyone is, right? So,
yep.
So, that made me and my help to coaches just even that much more accessible. So, that's going to be as I continue to evolve, how I want to you know, I've got to keep that in mind to, you know, think mobile, because that's where people are. Right.
So how many of those group meetings are you doing in a week? And when you have one and you send somebody an invite, how many coaches are taking part? Or are you sending that to a certain tier of membership and then people who are available who want to jump on for that particular topic or that particular call do so? Or how do you handle that?
Yeah, so the chat room, the group me chat room, is just available to any of our gold medal members. They can join or and participate or not. It's not like they can. So I have a lot of members who really don't bother with it. I have some who don't stop. They're basketball junkies, and they're right in there probably every day of the week, all the time. We have group meetings where we get on a Skype or a GoToMeeting and we talk about a particular topic once a month. And each coach is afforded a one-on-one session with me to talk strategy, share their practice plans, look at video, whatever they want help with. Maybe they've read something I've written and they have more questions about it. And whatever they want their time to be spent with one-on-one, they get that once a month for an hour. Right now I'm still able to keep up with that, but it gets hard sometimes. But again, it's a pact that I made. I will make myself available. Whatever what that looks like may change. What that sounds like, and the frequency of that may change, but I wanted something different than a website you join and just get plays and drills, right? If I'm going to do this, my motivation was sort of a replicate the feeling of a team, right? I have a team now. They're just like any team I ever coached of high school athletes. I have a team of coaches. I've got some that are equivalent to gym rats, right? Gym rat is there at every open gym. Every, you know, you make 500 shots a day, he makes 1,000. If you say, you know, I've got coaches like that. They're at every seminar. They do their one-on-one every month. They're always asking questions. They're always emailing me. And I got coaches who I got to kind of like, hey, man, you joined up. What are you?
Are you out there? What are we doing?
Like, I appreciate the money every month, but like, you come on, you know, just like I had athletes, like a lot of times it was like the really talented ones, right? Like that I was like, hey, you know, we had a weight room workout that I know, where were you, you know? So it's not unlike any team I've ever coached.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer at Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
So how do you balance that personal interaction with your coaches with the content creation that you obviously have to do to get the videos and plays and manage your social media? How do you balance those two, having the conversations, the personal touch, which is obviously critical to your business. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, you've got to have stuff out there for people to see and to find in order for them to eventually find you and continue to grow your membership or keep the members you have. So how do you balance those two things?
I use time blocking. So I sort of, instead of like responding, like I'm in the middle of making a video and an email comes through or something and I stop the video, I just time block. Like these 2 hours I'm making videos, this hour I'm answering chats or emails or, you know, communicating. These hours I'm watching more video or diagramming with FastDraw or whatever. I just sort of, I'm not the best about writing it down and planning it like, you know, by the minute, but I sort of keep it in my head like, all right, for the next 2 hours, I'm going to do this. And I try to block out distractions instead of just responding and bouncing back and forth between the tasks. I think that's a recipe for messing up a video or something like that. Like, I'll just create more work for myself by not time blocking. So that's really my main method. Am I the best at it every single day? Probably not, but that's at least the way I start out the day.
the best of intentions.
I was going to say that pretty much sums up my day every day. So
yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I really think it's vital now that I've got a membership group. They get priority. If there's something they want, they've invested, they're putting in the work, they get priority. So that's kind of where I start, right? And then content creation can get put on the back burner if it needs to serve the guys who are invested. So that's sort of another guiding light I try to follow.
Gotcha. All right. I want to ask you two questions related to your content. Number one, what is the hardest type of content for you to produce? And then which type of content do you enjoy producing the most?
The hardest is writing. I would say hands down. There's if you meet from a novelist to a nonfiction writer, it's really hard. It's supposed to be hard. And maybe on the outside, looking in, writing, what a glamorous life that, you know, Ernest Hemingway must have led,
right,
or something like
right,
that. But
right,
like,
right.
But like to, and I'm not comparing my writing to Ernest Hemingway. Don't
no, I understood.
But like, it's really, writing is really hard, and dealing with, you know, proofreading and making it sound where, okay, if I was a reader, am I picking up what you're putting down? You know, like, that's the hardest. I would say, it's the one I tend to procrastinate the most because it is hard
and
it takes discipline. It's tough. So that's the hardest. Even about a subject, you know, it's still hard. I would say the one I enjoy the most is a video editing and video creation. I kind of look at that almost like artistic. It's like a creative outlet. So, you know, timing, you know, putting clips together and making them look, you know, with it, making it make sense, and sort of it's sort of like it's a creative outlet that I kind of get lost in sometimes because it of the creative nature of it.
Yeah, the video piece of it, I think also when you it's a little bit easier to see what the finished product, what somebody else is going to see, whereas writing, I think a lot of times is, you know, the perception of people who are reading your writing. I can't always anticipate when I haven't been writing nearly as much as I was before mm-hmm. I started the podcast, but I always felt like you would put writing out and you were never quite sure what the perception of your writing was going to be. Whereas when I do a video or did a video, you kind of have an idea of what the feedback is going to be, or wow, this video is really good, or that one's it's okay.
Right.
And I feel like I have a better sense of what that type of content, or even with the podcast, I feel like the podcast, we know pretty much immediately when we finish, we're like, oh, that episode is going to be really, really good because either the guest was really good or mm-hmm. we just felt like it went really smoothly and the audio was great. And whereas with writing, I think it's almost like that time delay of, okay, I finished writing it, I've edited it, now I'm putting it out into the world, and it's just not as immediate, the feedback. And that's, I think, one of the challenging pieces beyond what you said, which is that it's a grind to come up with topics, to word it right, to make sure that it's interesting. So like you said, people who don't just read the first paragraph and then are like, ugh, you know, I'm clicking off this and going somewhere else.
Right.
Totally agree.
They say writing is one of the most vulnerable acts a human can undertake, right? So you're putting yourself out to be judged. So that's tough.
That's one of the
barriers that I think keeps people from publicly, at least publicly, sharing their thoughts in written form, because it's a vulnerable act, and I've definitely felt that.
All right. So we talked earlier before the podcast about the fact that a lot of times coaches feel like they're on an island and they're in their own little world, and they have these problems that come up and that arise, and they feel like, oh, I'm the only person out there that this has ever happened to. And why is this happening to me? And why does my team do this? And you mentioned that those coaches come to you with those problems and feel like they're completely isolated and have nowhere to turn. And you can have the conversation with them. Look, I just talked to four guys who have the exact same problem. So I want to go and touch on some of those things that are most common, maybe, that you hear from coaches. Let's just touch on a couple of them, and we can go maybe as in depth as we want to, as we get into the conversation, but let's just throw out a couple things that a typical high school coach might face, things that you see commonly being brought to you as problems, and then how you go about maybe some of the advice that you give a coach on those particular topics.
Yeah. So you're exactly right. Like there's a tendency for humans to believe that their problems are unique. We're all guilty of it. And, you know, coaches are no different. So I'll hear a coach say something like, well, you know, that sounds like a good idea, coach, but I really don't think I can implement that because at this school here that I'm at, there's, you know, and I just, like you said, I just talked to four different guys who, you know, basically said some version of the same thing. So first thing I would tell coaches are, your problem is not unique, right? And I think a moment ago I referenced that the team of coaches that I work with is no different than any team of players that I've worked with. And sometimes I had to be hard on my players, right? And sometimes it's uncomfortable because we're of equal age and we're peers, but like, I feel like I've got to do it. That's my duty. So sometimes I have to be hard on the coaches, and I'll tell them something to the effect of, somewhere in the United States, in the world, whatever, some coach is dealing with more obstacles than you are and doing a better job in getting better outcome. Somewhere that's happening. So we can talk about your unique obstacles, which aren't that unique at your school, if you'd like, but somewhere somebody's dealing with more problems than you face and doing and getting better results.
So do you find yourself having to, I'm trying to think of the right way to phrase this, to redirect the coaches from complaining and thinking about the problems and start pointing them in direction of solutions? Because I know that, again, in education, whether you're a teacher or whether you're a coach, that when things go bad, the first tendency I think we all have is to kind of complain to our colleagues or say, oh, if only this was different, instead of going and saying, okay, this is what I have, let's look for solutions. So do you find yourself kind of fulfilling that role as, I don't know, a counselor, or just, you know, trying to get them to think about, here's the things that you should be focusing on rather than focus on the problem? Let's focus on what's the solution to the situation that you're in.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that one of the skills that I try to help coaches with is putting on blinders, is what we call it. Like, just putting on blinders to tons of things, like you're talking about, obstacles, distractions, putting on blinders and focusing on what's actually in your circle of control. Because what I have found is like that can use some improvement most often, you know,
right.
The way you're dealing with what's actually in your control could be done better. And the thing you're complaining about might not be such a big hurdle if you were, focusing on your circle of control a little bit more efficiently. Right. So definitely, I would say, I thought when I started doing this, it would just be about sharing drills and diagrams and plays. And that's was my intention. And after some initial conversations with coaches, I started to think, you know, wow, like there's a real, almost like a counseling need that I'm hearing, right? That maybe I wasn't prepared for. That's definitely not what I set out to do. But I felt like some of the things that I had to, before we had some of these micro conversations about where do I put my five man in our zone offense and what foot goes here into the catch. And we'll get to all that, but like there's some macro level things that I said, whoa, this has got to become the priority over the tactical and technical stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, so, I can see, I think that's a way. No, I agree. I think that's a way that, too, that coaching over the last, again, we could go back however long we want to go back, but I think that coaching has changed in that way, in that back 20, 30 years ago, I think there was a much more of a focus on the tactical side of it and much less time spent thinking about the culture, the relationships, the trying to get players to buy in and be a part of the team and whatever. I think a coach a long time ago was much more likely to just be like, this is the way it is, and you're either going to do it or you're not. Whereas now coaches are much more concerned, and understandably so, because the more you can build those relationships, the better you can push your team and get more out of them and be able to build the type of family atmosphere and to build your team in order to have success. So what are one or two of those culture things that coaches come to you with frequently that you're able to help them with, or you're able to kind of give them some guidance?
I think the number one thing that I call it sort of like our intake process. And again, their culture with their team's not really my forte. Their team's not my audience. They are.
Right.
So I start with them, and I encountered so many coaches in the early days of doing this that really just had no idea who they were as a coach. Right. So like, yeah, last year we ran the flex, this year we ran this, this next year we ran that. And they're just kind of everywhere as a coach, you know. And I just, when I look around at the teams that deep in the playoffs that were knocking me out every year, or the teams that turn up in the state tournament every year, it's the same characters. And not only is it the same characters, I could like go to Siberia for 5 years and come back and watch them play, and they look the same. It's like the same looking kids doing the same looking stuff. Like, and that's where we start with the coach, is what do you want to do as a coach? Quit reacting and create your own future. So I make them sit down and spell out their coaching philosophy. We call it a game model. I got it from a terrific book called Game Changer by Fergus Conley. I took it and ran with that. I think it's a great idea. I give him full credit, but I've taken it and ran with it with the coaches of like in all four phases of basketball, from half court offense to transition defense to transition offense. So that's the game cycle, right? At any moment in a game, you're in one of those, right? So tell me what's your philosophy here? What's your philosophy here? Write it down. Tell me what you're trying to accomplish. Then show me your drills that you're to get them thinking about who they are as a coach.
And how hard is that for a coach?
Extremely hard. Extremely hard. I coach that way. It came naturally. It's just sort of how I saw the game and how I saw the profession and the job of coaching. I guess someone would call it like a systems coach, like you coach a system. And I've found out since been doing this and having these conversations with coaches is that that's the minority camp, right? Especially in the sport of basketball, that it seems like, let me see what kind of players I have this year, and then I'll decide what I'm going to run. I try to move coaches a little bit more toward there's good basketball. This is what it looks like up here. This is your player's current ability to play good basketball, and the space in between is your job description. We're not bringing down the basketball. We're bringing up the players. So, again, that's hard because it's not instantaneous, right? But when I look around, it's all around us. The same teams win it every year. Like, I could, in your state, in my state, you give me at the high school level, give me 10 chances to list the state champion. I'm going to get who it is.
Right, understood. Right after you, we're going to talk to Coach Carl Kramer from Archbishop Moeller High School in Cincinnati. And he's won the last two Division I, which is the big school championships in Ohio. And he's won 5 total. So
yeah, he's probably got great talent, but so do other places.
Yep.
Right.
You get to his program pretty quickly. Let's put it that way. If you're putting together the list.
Yeah. So what I try to get coaches to do is sort, if they can, to, as we're talking about X's and O's, as we're talking about an offense or a defense, do your best not to envision your 3 or 4 returning lettermen or letter winners or returning scholarship players or whatever, and just learn the game, right? And you'll see that it's your duty to bring players up to the game, not bring the game down to your players. Honestly, I don't compliment them very much, but football coaches are really good at this. Football coaches, this is one of the things they do better than basketball coaches, right? Like here in Texas, we have amazing high school football programs, right? And if the varsity is running the spread offense, so's the JV, so's the 9th grade, so's the 8th grade, so's the 7th grade. Those coaches all report to the head coach. They get their playbooks from him. They get their drills from him. They get their practice. Everything pop, 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 right? It's not like their varsity's running 5-out spread. Their JV's running the wishbone. Everything is in aligned and seamless, and there's a process. And kids come through that process with deep knowledge of something rather than surface level knowledge of many things.
So how important is it? And so I'm reading between the lines here, but what I'm guessing that I'm hearing you say is that if I'm a high school varsity coach, what I want to do is I want to have my hand directly in my JV program, my freshman program, my middle school program, and my youth program, and begin to work with those coaches to implement the system on, again, taking it down a notch at each level that you go, but start working on the terminology, the skills, the things that the kid is going to need to be a successful varsity basketball player. The foundation for that should be being laid in the 3rd, 4th, 5th grade, so that as that kid progresses and we keep adding layers to what they need to know to be a successful varsity player, those pieces are going to be in place. Is that what I hear you saying?
Absolutely. It's how the best operate. It's not only how the best operate in basketball, it's how they operate in all sports and in business. It's how it goes. And the reason why it's such a barrier to so many coaches is because it doesn't happen overnight. Right? Like you got to put your year one as a coach at a new school or first year head coach or whatever, your year one is probably the predominance of the time you spend is program, not team. I say this all the time to coaches. It's like, you weren't hired to be the varsity basketball team's coach. You were hired to direct the basketball program. There's a big difference.
Big difference, huge difference. What are the excuses that a coach will throw out at you for why they can't do that?
Systematic excuses, like, you know, I've got this junior high coach who, you know, they've been here forever and they, you know, they just kind of run their own thing and I can't get them to sort of get on board with what we're trying to do. That would be one. Or, you know, just sort of like almost like logistical barriers, like we don't have a gym for our junior high kids, or we don't have enough space for our JV to work out. And so like all those logistical barriers, I find those to be more of the minor objections. The most major hurdle is the head coach himself can't decide what it is he's going to align right?
Right.
Like, he can't decide what it is, like, what is my program 7 through 12 going to be about? And that's huge. It's like all the logistical things might be there. Yeah, I can hire my JV coach, or yeah, we got plenty of space in our junior high. And you've got all these luxuries, but like, you're not anywhere as a coach.
So what do you do? So what type of questions then, when you get into this situation where you're looking at this entire program, the coach is resistant to it for whatever reason, whether it's excuses or whether it's logistics or whatever the reason the coach might have for objecting that to that, then what types of questions do you ask that coach to get them to think about or to see or to understand the importance of building that, again, let's just call it a K to 12 basketball program? What do you do? How do you guide them in the direction that they need to get in order to see that it should be a total school program and not just a varsity team, as you talked about before?
Yeah. So, honestly, I just sort of listen to them first and hear out sort of maybe what they've been, you know, the way they've sort of gone about things in the past. And that's the first step, is just to sort of, maybe they've already doing a good job of this and they've come to my program to just get better at it. But if, you know, I'd say the first question I tend to ask them is this, is what do you want to see when you watch your team play?
That's a great question. What do you want to see when you watch your team play?
I might ask them like, just to like, okay, I know what you did with your team, but like, what teams do you like to watch? Who would you pay to watch? Right? Like, think questions like that to get them out of the, you know, out of the micro, like, here's my team. Here's my four girls that are got coming back. My four guys that I got coming back. I got a tall one, a short one, a fat one, a slow one. Like, you know, like stop. What do you want? What do you like? What do you want to see on Tuesday and Friday night? All right. Start there. So many coaches these days are going to leave this profession not on their own terms. They're going to get fired. They're going to get riffed. They're going to get whatever. Maybe someday high school basketball is obsolete. Who knows? Coach on your own terms. Start with, what do I want to see? Right. And then articulate that in that game model. This is what I want to see. Okay. How do we get there from here? We got to do this in the seventh grade. We got to do this, you know, we got to get ninth grade doing this. And by 11th and 12th grade, we got to be able to do all these things. Right. So you ask me what questions I ask them. It's that one first. What do you want to see when you watch your team play?
I think it's a great question. I think that if you're a high school coach out there, or you're a college coach, or you're a coach on any level, I think if you ask yourself that question, and, you know, I'm obviously asking that to myself in my own head, and in a lot of ways, the things that I would want to do as a coach, and I haven't coached in high school for a long time, and when I did, I was an assistant coach, but even with some of the, you know, my own kids' teams, I think about how I might want to play, and then how I end up playing, and, you know, it's not always exactly the same as what I would envision in a perfect world. And so you've kind of got me thinking about, how could I make it look more like I might want it to look, and what would those challenges be? And I think as a high school coach, that's something that you really have to wrestle with, because you have, I mean, you're in charge. You have the capability of being able to do all the things that you've described, which is to put together your program. And obviously there are different, people have different situations, understandably, but the bottom line is, if you want to make those things happen, there is a way for you to make those things happen. And I think that's a great, great place for any coach to start, is, what do you want your team to look like? I think it's a great question.
Yeah. We call it pillars. I make a coach sort of, articulate three, maybe four. Like, when you watch my team play, you will see bullet point one, bullet point two, bullet point three, right? That's where we start. Articulate that, write it down, make a poster, make a t-shirt, something. This is what you will see. This is what any coach scouting your team would see. this is what a novice fan, like your wife or your grandmother, like, man, those guys really run the floor. You know, like a coach might call it transition offense or fast break or something, but like no one would miss it. This is how branded we've become. Right. I mean, you have to look no further than, you know, college basketball programs that we can sort of all relate to. Like when I watch North Carolina play, I'm about to see the secondary break.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah.
I watch Virginia play, I'm about to see me some pack line. Right. You know, like obviously they get to recruit those players and that helps, obviously, but right. Like, so does their competition. They don't get every recruit they want. Right. That's what those coaches are. That's what they want to see. Right. I would say that their ability to recruit, I don't know if it's an even swap and pick their players, but I mean, they might like to be able to work with players for 6 or 7 years like you get to as a high school coach. You know, that might be seen as an even swap to them, you know. So you don't get to recruit necessarily at the high school level, and some of you might, but colleges to different degrees do. But like you can be what you want given process and time for it to work. The pillars, the making the pillars is difficult. It's difficult to get coaches to sort of say, okay, here's what I want to go big on. Here's the things that like I want to go big on that we're going to start creating our identity around. It's hard, but in retrospect, it's actually the easiest part because it's just talk at that point, right?
Right.
So what we say after you make your pillars and get all that articulated, and okay, I got it. I'm getting to the root of who I want to be as a coach and what I want my teams to look like, felt hard, but that's actually the easiest part. The second part is what we call a big deletion party, right? So like go to your filing cabinet, go to your hard drive, whatever, and like get clean house, Marie Kondo this place, right? Like get it. Like if it's not in line with these three pillars, it's gotta go. Delete, trash, burn it, whatever, right?
Yep. Yep.
So that's step two, right? So now I got to start designing my practices around these pillars, and I got to start making sure my assistant coaches and the people and that coach underneath me, or if I'm a college coach, the players I recruit to sort of speak to these pillars, right? And then that's hard. Because it's like you're letting go of things you've accumulated and drills you've done and things like that were comfortable to you, but like, yeah, I want to cling to that. Like there's an emotional detachment to some of those things. But still, that's even easier than, okay, we got our pillars. We did our deletion party. We're planning practices around our pillars. We'll get there. We got our first game and we lose by 18. We got our first game and second game and we lose by 8, you know, and like, oh, now whispers like, ooh, this isn't working. I said, what's the deal? You know, like that's the hardest part. That's the challenge.
I couldn't agree with you more. That is, I think, a huge, huge.
Sticking to it.
It's easy. I've always kind of been of this mentality that it's easy to sell, fill in the blank, whatever you want that blank to say. But it's easy to sell whatever when you're 0-0. It's much easier, or it's much harder to sell whatever when you're 0-5 or when you're 6-9 or whatever the case may be. It's easier to, or it's harder to sell it to your players, your parents, your fans, your administration when you're not winning. So I'm guessing that the next step in that process is you have to go back and think about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and just reinforce the fact that this is the way we're going to do things. This is my why, and I believe in it, and I'm going to continue to believe in it whether I'm 0-10 or I'm 10-0.
Yeah, I would say the variable that coaches struggle with is the timetable, right? They can do the pillars conversation. They can plan the practices around their pillars, and they can go into that 0-0 and somewhere in their mind, they've got to grapple with the actual timetable that it's going to take a couple seasons to for us to see these this fruit through, you know, to, for this to bear fruit. That when it doesn't happen instantly, they want to, I wish I didn't throw away that file full of 57 set plays because I really want to joystick this team to 500 instead of, you know, 10 and 14. I'd rather go 14 and 14, like you got to aim big to do something big, right? Like I call it aiming for average. Like I talked to a lot of coaches who, and early on, before they've been, you know, tongue lashed by my sermons, you know, they're like, yeah, coach, I'd like to talk to you about how you'd modify this or that. And I'm like, oh, this guy's not going to like what I have to say, you know, because I don't modify stuff. I modify players. We get better. We get better. That's what we do. So if I got to modify something, I'm going to modify the players. I'm going to modify their skills. And by modify, I mean improve, right? So we sort of decide on our X's and O's so we can quit having to learn and adopt and memorize and walk through and 5-on-0. We're going to decide on that, stick a pin in it, and get to work on our players.
If you're a basketball coach in the greater Cleveland area and you have a passion for teaching the game and might be interested in joining the Head Start Basketball Camp coaching staff this summer, please reach out to us via email at headstartbasketball@usa.net.
All right, so that goes to the next question, which is, you mentioned right at the top of the podcast that you had a lot of coaches that you played against or that you were colleagues with during your coaching days that said they liked the way that your teams played and some of the things that you did in practice. So let's talk a little bit about what practice design should look like in order to get the improvement that you just mentioned from your players. Is there, obviously we don't have to go into the specific drill idea, but I'm sure there's an overriding philosophy in terms of what you believe in terms of helping players to improve, what that practice design looks like. So can you share some of those things with us?
Absolutely. Start with the game and work backwards. So that was sort of what evolved to how I wanted my teams to practice. So we start with the problems the game presents and work backwards. I think so many coaches start with their offense or drills or fundamentals, right? And it's like they're trying to tame the game, right? Like they want to control the game on Friday night, and they're doing it through the way they tell this guy, you got to have your pivot foot right here and pass with this elbow at 47.6 degrees, right? Like they're trying to tame the game, right? It's never happened. It's not going to happen, right? So what I tried to do with my players is we start with the game and work backwards. The problems the game presents, we replicate those in practice. You're disadvantaged on defense. You've got an advantage on offense, 3-on-2, 4v3, whatever, you know, like we wanted our games to look like, or we wanted our practices to look like the game, even if it's microcosms of the game, 1-on-1, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, every single day.
So I'm guessing that you're not a big proponent of 5-on-0 drills or 3-man weave where it's just things that are never going to happen in a game. You're advocating, we just talked with Coach Chris Oliver,
right.
From Basketball Immersion, and he was tremendous. And I'm getting the same sense from you in terms of the fact that, you know, you have to replicate the game in practice. Otherwise the learning doesn't transfer. And as you know, I've said, and I know Chris said that learning that way is messy. It doesn't look as pretty as putting four lines out there and throwing some cones down on the floor and having kids make moves around the cones. But what we're really after is the transfer of that learning to actual games. And in order to do that, you have to put kids into game situations. And I think I've definitely come around on that in the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years as I've gotten into more of just studying the game and learning more about it than probably I should have as a young coach. Yeah. I definitely think that that games-based approach that you're advocating is key, because it allows for the type of learning transfer that is going to help your players get better.
Yeah, I think that Chris does a fabulous job articulating all this stuff better than a guy from Deep East Texas could. I'll definitely concede to him that you know, the way he articulates things is terrific, and I would say that, like, even without maybe the, you know, that's just sort of the way that I saw coaching. I don't know how to explain it any other way, and how
I
try.
It makes total sense.
And I think don't mean to interrupt, but like, I think one thing I touched on in my basketball background, I played 1 year of varsity basketball. Like, I've talked to thousands of coaches, and it's uncanny how many of them, how'd you get into coaching? Well, my dad was a coach for 30 years. And like, it's uncanny how many coaches are legacy, son of coaches. Like, that's great. It means they were born with a basketball in their hand and were, you know, in a gym all their life. And that's great. That's probably the way it should be, but that doesn't come without drawbacks. The drawback would be they're full of absorbed knowledge, right?
They're set in their ways. I agree.
They're full of absorbed knowledge. Like, they come from a long line of coaches, and they played high school basketball for 4 years, college basketball for 4 years. You know, that's great. And obviously that has a lot of benefits for becoming a coach too. But like, one of the possible drawbacks is, like, when you get your own whistle, your own gym, right? This absorbed knowledge sometimes is standing in your way. And whereas, like, I didn't play that long, and wasn't around a basketball family. And so I feel like maybe I just see it like, you know, that's kind of silly. I don't see why people have been doing it that way for years, you know, I did have a coach who was dribble around some cones and things like that. And one thing I filed away, even though my intention wasn't to be a basketball coach, was like, if I ever was one, I'm not going to do this. Right? So I'd say the practice is sort of like, start from the game and work backwards. I really call it phasic, meaning those four phases that I mentioned, offense, transition defense, half court offense, I try to build those in and stay cognizant in my practice planning and help coaches stay cognizant in their practice planning with, like, hey, you got too much of half court O and half court D, when a third, two thirds, maybe more of the game is going to be spent in transition. So I really try to help coaches keep an eye on being phasic in their practice planning, all four phases, every day, any chance we can get to add a there and back to a drill, or add, that conversion element, as Bob Knight used to call it, the conversion to offense to defense is just as important as the actual half court situation. So I tried to do as much of that as I could. The practice planning template I used was, and that I try to help coaches with, is sort of like thinking groupings, like two-player drills, two-player games, group those together, three-player drills and games, group those together in your planning. So you kind of go from twos to threes to fours, and you're not having to re-explain drills. You're already in groups of three, groups of four, groups of two, and you say, hey, we're doing this next. And so that's sort of some highlights of the practice ideas I try to share.
Yeah, I think that organizational piece and time management is something that I struggled with as a younger coach. And I think a lot of younger coaches, sometimes you get in your head, you have these different ideas, and you want to go from this one cool drill to the next cool drill to the next one. And you spend a lot of time explaining, or a lot of time where kids are just standing around and not really doing things. And obviously we all have limited gym time and gym space, and you want to be as efficient as you can from that standpoint. But you also want to be efficient because it keeps kids on their toes. It keeps them engaged. And that's really how you get better, when your kids are involved and they're active and they're engaged in what you're doing, you're going to get a lot more out of them than when they have to stand around and listen to you talk or explain a drill or get everything organized. It's just the more efficient you can be with time, I think the better off you are for sure.
Yeah, I think too, and you mentioned that Chris Oliver touched on it too, is in my wording, again, not as eloquent as Chris, would be we coaches sometimes have this high desire for practice to be neat, right? Like,
yep.
We pass layup and it looks great. And well, we're really looking sharp today, aren't we? Like, well, I mean, you could train monkeys to do this, right?
Right,
like,
yeah.
This is not, you know, this is more like a recital than it is a practice, right? It's like you're performing rather than competing. So, I would say try to lessen your desire for everything to be neat and clean and perfect in practice, because that's just not the nature of the competition.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. What's a recent problem or question that a coach has come to you that sticks out in your mind, something that has come to you in the last, let's say, month or so that you could share with us and share with the audience?
Yeah, it seems like, you know, a lot of what we do is I've really tried to educate myself and ergo the coaches I work with on analytics, you know, the sort of burgeoning science of data in basketball. And more what that's pointing to is that the three-point shot, the spacing needed to keep up with teams that can play super efficiently is really forcing the hand of a lot of teams. And it's starting to trickle down from the professional to the college to the high school to where, like, yeah, we can make mid-range shots and we can get the ball into our post and we might even play that pretty well, but that's like kicking field goals and the other team scoring touchdowns, right? You know, so I think the biggest challenge I've had in this offseason, it's since I've sort of started sharing the analytics, and we have a huge spreadsheet of all the coaches in our membership. We report all of our four-factor data. I keep it all on a spreadsheet. We have like a competition at the end of the season. The coach that has the highest points per possession, I send them a T-shirt and make a big deal over them on the girls' side and the boys' side, women's or men's. And that knowledge is great. Like to know more about our sport and not to be sort of guessing, like it seems like we did for years, right?
Right. Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like, it's great, but it's also really kind of a slap in the face to a lot of coaches of like, oh wow, this is what winning teams look like in terms of efficiency, and this is my team. Ooh, I got a long way to go, right? So I would say in the past month, since the season's been over and we really kind of got those numbers really unpacked and analyzed and really we're able to see like wins and losses correlate really strongly with being able to do this, you know, these stats are really high here. And it's really the problem that this is a very long-winded answer to get to the point of shooting, is that teams and players just don't have enough shooting to operate at that high, that peak efficiency level that championship teams operate at. So again, it's a double-edged sword. Now, you know, because of the analytics and the data, is like, now, you know, right? Like at least, you know, what you should be prioritizing, what winning looks like on paper. Now, you know, you don't have to guess anymore, but the other edge of that sword is like, we got a long way to go.
Yeah, I can see that. So when you're armed with that analytics data, I know that you have those four things that you're primarily looking at, because I saw that as I was kind of researching and looking at. I know you have effective field goal percentage, I think, is one of them.
There's a terrific book called Basketball on Paper by Dean Oliver. He's sort of the forefather of basketball analytics, and basically, he sort of boiled down winning to four factors, and that being effective field goal percentage, offensive rebounding percentage, turnover percentage, and free throw rate. So those are the, you know, the four main drivers of winning. And they're weighted differently at different levels, but by and large, just generally speaking, effective field goal percentage and turnover percentage, then offensive rebounding, then the free throw factor, are, you know, plus or minus a percentage point or two from the NBA on down. But like roughly speaking, that's sort of the order. And that's what we found in our data that I've been tracking that for 2 years. And I think we had cataloged like 1500 games. So we're starting to amass, you know, some pretty telling data ourselves. And, but all it's done is just echoing the work that Dean did years ago by studying NBA data. So we've not uncovered any new discoveries or anything. We're just sort of confirming it, I guess you could say. But yeah, so you know what we're looking at there is what drives winning? What drives winning statistically? What do we have to be able to do or not allow our opponent do to win games? And it just helps paint a clearer picture of that. And it takes away a little bit of like what I call the coach speak of like, we got to want it more and we got to hustle harder and we got to be tougher. Like, okay. You know, that sound, but like, this is what we actually have to do that we can.
Right. But we have to be tougher, but the way we have to be tougher is we got to get more offensive rebounds. We got to crash the boards there.
Or keep our opponents from doing so. Yes.
Correct. Yeah,
exactly. Or like, correct. We got to quit turning the ball over. We got to turn people over, or whatever. Yeah. But it gives you the specifics. It gives you some tangible objectives to aim for. Absolutely.
Yeah, because a lot of times you said, like, you know, I love what you said there about, hey, we got to be tougher, or we got to play harder, because those are things that coaches say all the time. And
who doesn't want their team to do that? I mean, right. Everybody wants that.
But you know, think about that from a player's perspective. And I'm a player and I say, okay, coach wants me to be tougher. Well, how can I translate that into a specific action? Whereas coach says, we need to get more offensive rebounds. I know what that means. Now, there may be some technique that has to be taught or some, you know, some work on that has to go into it. But I at least understand what I'm supposed to do. I need to get offensive rebounds, or I need, conversely, as you said, I need to box out on the defensive end so the other team doesn't get second shots.
Absolutely.
And so, when you turn something that is generic into something that's specific, to me, that's one of the things that good coaches do a great job of. I know there was the John Wooden study of, you know, he spent time giving actual instruction. He gave very little praise and very little criticism. It was more just, okay, I see what you're doing. Now do this. Mm-hmm. And that's something that everybody has to work on. I know that I try to be conscious of it, and I don't always do a good job of it. Where, you know, I'll find myself saying, hey, come on, we got to D up. And well, what does that even mean? That's not helping anybody. That's just me listening to myself talk. And I think the more specific that we can be, the better off we're going to be as coaches.
Yeah. So it all ties together. So let's tie something I spoke of earlier to this. It's like we ask coaches to make their pillars and spell out their game model in every four phases. So that's step one. Another step would be, okay, You've got your pillars and this is what we're going to be about. This on offense, this on defense. Here's what any coach would see when they watch us. Okay, how are we going to measure those things? That to say, hey, we're living out our pillars. And to me, what this does is it takes that talk and makes it measurable. It makes it quantifiable. We win when we do this and it speaks to this pillar. So again, it's if I do anything else with coaches, I hope that it's to help them articulate what they want to see, make a plan, help them make a plan to get there, and then give them some help on actually quantifying where they are and how far they've got to go.
That's fantastic. And I think that we're coming up on an hour and a half, Randy, and that is a great spot for us to kind of wrap things up and give you a chance to share how people can get in touch with you, how they can find out more about all the great things you're doing with Radius Athletics, and just give them a way to get in contact with you. And then if there's any parting shot that you want to share before we wrap things up, you can go ahead and do that as well.
Sure. I try to keep everything simple to where you can get a hold of me anywhere you see Radius Athletics. It's radiusathletics.com, Radius Athletics on Twitter. Randy at Radius Athletics is my email. That's like I said, I'll get back to you. I'd love to I just love having these conversations with coaches, and I find them to be very rewarding. I would say that, like, there have been moments in the 4 years I've been doing this that have surpassed the rewards that I got as a coach emotionally. Like when a coach tells me, like, coach, I was lost as a coach and you've helped me. When a coach is able to send me a clip of a player or a team or doing something we've taught, and it's that quintessential, just like, wow, what a great example. Like, they're so proud. And so, like, that's as rewarding or more as any trophy I ever lifted. So I really want coaches to engage, and I just like helping out. So hopefully someone listening will hear something tonight that they feel like, man, I could really use some help with that, and reach out.
I'm sure they will. I think the conversation that we had tonight was tremendously valuable for coaches to be able to hear. And I think that the things that you're doing for coaches, even notwithstanding the specifics, but just the general idea of what you're able to do and the service you ever are able to provide. Because as I said right at the very beginning, I think so many times coaches feel like they're lost on an island and that it's only happening to them. And the reality is that it's happening to a lot of people, and you've been in a position to be able to hear from lots of coaches and be able to learn from their experiences and from your own experiences. And I think then consequently be able to help the coaching fraternity to improve themselves. And we can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight, Randy. It's been a pleasure to have this conversation. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
The Hoopheads Podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.